If you would, please help me to offer a warm Tulare County welcome to Georgia.
No pressure. Hi, I'm Georgia. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and to be sober. Thank you, Bill and Suzanne, for hosting us. Thank you, Marcus, for coming with me. Marcus is my friend, my special friend. We've been friends for a while. We worked together at the Midnight Mission in Skid Row in Los Angeles. And he's somebody that I respect a great deal and have been a fan of for a long time. And we've been dating for a little less than a year. And he came with me tonight, so thank you. My backup band stopped. I'm disappointed. I was looking forward to having accompaniment tonight, but all right, I guess I'll go solo. Grateful to be here. This is a wonderful event. We don't have anything like this in Los Angeles, any events like this. And everybody's been very hospitable, and I thank you for that, for making us feel so welcome. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I just turned 25 years sober in February, which is kind of a big deal. And for this girl, anyway. And I got sober when I was 24, so that makes me older than I thought I'd ever be. I never dreamed I would live this long. And I realize that there are people here who are older than me, but this is the oldest I've ever been, and it is shocking. Yeah, I don't remember when I had my first drink, but drinking was always a part of my life. I was drinking out of the adult's drinks when I was a kid, and I feel almost like I tapered on. There wasn't like that first drink where I went, oh, wow. You know, it was like alcohol was always a part of my life, and then I just kept drinking more and more and more. I do have a picture with my dad when I was 11 months old, and he's tipping a beer stein back into my mouth, and maybe that was my first drink when I was 11 months, but I was arrested for drinking in public when I was 11, so I know it was a problem by then. My dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I was raised by a single mom who worked 3 jobs to support us, and she was more or less angry or depressed when she was at home. She never dated again. She never had any friends. I don't think that she had signed up to raise a child by herself, and at that time she was 38 years old, and in those days that was an older parent, and so I think she was resentful about that. I can't really speak to that, but if you've ever been around somebody that you know just doesn't like you, that's the feeling I had in my house growing up. And so the way my mom dealt with that is she just watched TV, smoked her more menthols, and maybe I'd walk into the room and say something like hello, and she'd be like, not now. Like, she couldn't even, she was already at 10 with me just saying hello. So, I was forced, I tell you, to find my love in other places. And there was no shortage of the kind of love I was finding. And, you know, it's funny, I share with you my story. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I was such a victim until I got to that fourth column of the fourth step where we look at our faults. And I was, I had a lot of things that fell on my side of the street, and my first sponsor used to say that she was friendly. I would say that I was a little bit more than friendly, but I had this idea, and I couldn't articulate it at the time, that if somebody loved me, then I would be okay. And that's all I aspired to do and to be. I never aspired to do and be anything but loved, because I just knew that if I could find somebody to love me, then everything else would work itself out. That's what I was learning from all the TV shows I was watching. That's what I was learning from every movie. You know, the happy ending is you find love, and then everything else just falls into place. And it wasn't until I had double-digit sobriety that I learned that a man is not a plan. So I could have saved a lot of time, but I didn't know that. And so I had that idea, although unable to label it. And, you know, I wanted my mom's attention, because there were times where she was so funny and charismatic, and of course, she was my only family. I had a mom and a grandma, and I desperately wanted her attention and affection, but the way she dealt with me is she just said, you know what, you're going to do whatever you're going to do anyway. If you're going to smoke and drink, do it in the house. I'd rather you do it here than out there. And that's what I did. I've never had any rules. I've never been grounded. I've never had anyone saying, you need to go to school. She suggested it. She said, I really wish you would, but there was nobody saying, you know, go. I don't have any recollections of an audience with a proud parent waving or cheering me on. My mom didn't come to school events or anything like that. And so, but I liked school. You know, when I was young, I really liked school. I was smart. And so I was student body president in sixth grade. And then in seventh grade, I dropped out my drinking. That's when I was drinking on a regular basis. Dropped out, went to summer school, eighth grade, 13 years old. I was pregnant. And I ended up terminating that pregnancy at the urging of my boyfriend and my mom, and I drank over that for a really long time. And it wasn't until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and heard, you know, we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And that's been my experience. Even now with 25 years, which is kind of a big deal, things stay in a place of regret until I can either use that experience to help someone else or use it to change something I'm going through. But back then I was just collecting regrets. And so I had my first suicide attempt when I was 12. I had lost my virginity to a guy that I was a lot older. He was older than, I think he was 19, which was really old and creepy at that time. The reason why is because I couldn't bear the thought of him not liking me. Later, I had a sponsor call that rape, but I don't know. Anyway, by the time I was 13, like I said, I was pregnant. I had another suicide attempt when I was 13, and I was unsuccessful with both. Don't want to keep you in suspense. Thank you. So I hated myself desperately, and so the things that I was doing, I thought, would make you love me. But instead, it made you pity me, and it didn't make you love me, and I drank like a pig. So, like I said, I'm drinking at 11, I'm drinking at 12. That is the only place I'm finding any relief from the pain I was feeling. I feel like I had these really big emotions, like I was born singing the blues. You know, everything was so big and weighty. And when I drank, it was an escape from that. It was like an e-ticket out of my head. And I couldn't understand why I was here. I didn't understand the purpose of life. I wanted to be older so somehow I could understand what this madness was about. And so back then, the way I drank is I tended to enjoy a little Old English 800. I like a little 10 high whiskey with a Marlboro Red box back. If I have a choice of a chaser or a pack of cigarettes, I'm always going with the pack of cigarettes. And at that age, I was either stealing my booze or my mom would buy it. Now, my mom had this idea that if something were on sale and you didn't buy it, you were actually losing money. And although we were poor, my mom would come home with all sorts of crazy stuff. I remember she came home with this huge workbench. I mean, massive. We had to borrow a truck. It was like this big metal workbench. Put it in the patio. I'm like, Mom, why? I got such a good price, I couldn't let it go. And they just sat there and rested for years. So, but to my benefit, I remember her coming home one night with two cases of Meisterbrow. You know, if you buy one case, you get the second case free, so I would benefit from that. And one night she came home with a bottle of tequila and two matching shot glasses. Now, if you bought the tequila, you got the shot glasses for free. And so she presented them to me and said, I got these for you and your friend Ellen, so when Ellen comes over on Thursday night to watch The Facts of Life, you can drink this. And there's so many things wrong with that sentence. Because there was that sweetness that I was still watching The Facts of Life, you know, with Tootie and the gang. But I was pounding hard alcohol so I could go out and party. And, you know, you gotta drink before you go out because you don't know if there's going to be enough booze when you get out there. So my house was crazy. My mom, like I said, worked three jobs, so our house was not clean. Our neighborhood was, or our house was the house in the neighborhood that brought the price of your house down because it was, the yard was overgrown. It was crazy. And so I overcompensated for that by, like, I showered three times a day, feathered my hair like Farrah Fawcett. Those who don't know who she is, Google her. She was fabulous. So I'm doing that, pressing my jeans, trying to be perfect. Because, again, if you love me, then everything will be okay. You know, I one of my favorite shows today, even though it's only in rerun, is Sex and the City. And, you know, the girls go out and they drink these fabulous drinks, you know, like a cosmopolitan or a flavored martini, and they're so beautiful, and they're in these beautiful glasses, and the girls go out and they drink and they laugh and they talk about Mr. Big, and I think, oh, I bet I could do that, you know, I bet I could do that. And then I'm quickly reminded that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose. Like, that's how I drink. I used to be able to beer bong 5 beers, but it took a lot of projectile vomiting to get to that number. But these were things I was proud of. You know, I put out cigarettes with my bare feet. I could open a beer bottle with a lighter. And this is like as a teenager. I'm just thinking, this is so cool. And I was attracting people who also found that cool. So that'll let you know the people I was hanging around with. And I identify as an alcoholic. I believe my alcoholism gets me wherever I'm weak, though, and so that can be food, sex, money, drugs, whatever. You know, my alcoholism's always looking for a way out. Even today, you know, I have to work a diligent program so there's no breach in security. Like when Suzanne brought over that plate of cookies, would you like a cookie? No, I want 6. So I said, no, thank you. And but back then, what happened for me is in that striving to be perfect so I'd be loved and then I'd be okay, I started starving myself when I was 13 and started throwing up when I was 17 so I'd be skinny and perfect. And I didn't get any recovery from that until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and addressed my alcoholism. And what I mean by that is going to meetings, working with a sponsor, doing the steps, praying. You know, all the tools I've been given here, then and now, if I just work on those things every day, work on my spiritual condition, all my other issues seem to resolve. Friendship problems seem to resolve. Work problems seem to resolve. Finances. Now, health, maybe not so much, but I'm in a better spiritual condition to deal with that. But back then, I was just trying to fix how bad I felt all the time with whatever I could. And my friend Doug says, had I known I'd be speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said no to that joint, but I didn't. So I said yes. And I said yes to whatever you had that was free and whatever I could get my hands on. And I would go through different phases with drugs, and when they got out of control, I could always stop because I had booze. But as I was getting older, it was getting harder to start over. You know, I'd run my life into the ground, start over. And like I said, there was nobody saying you've got to do better, you should do better, or showing me the way. It was just like I had something inside of me that kept fighting for the good, you know. And when I would get to the edge, I'd be waiting for somebody to say, no, don't do it. But nobody did. I'd pick myself up by my bootstraps and get back in line. And, you know, but I was getting more and more tired as I was getting older. My mom, as soon as she knew I was going to graduate from high school, which was a miracle in itself that I was able to get all the credits to graduate with my class, decided that she was going to claim bankruptcy and move home to her mother, my grandmother, my only other family. And my grandmother, I believe, was the meanest human being who ever lived. And every long weekend, any vacation, any time that we went anywhere, it had to be to go see my grandma because my mom was really loyal to her. And my grandma used to drink a lot. In fact, she was known as the town drunk. But she would say, she'd always have like a big tumbler of vodka with like a splash of Hawaiian punch or something super ghetto. And she'd be like, you know, your grandma's not an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk. And now I know that those two words are the same thing, but I didn't know that then. And she used to tell me how disappointed she'd be in me, how disappointed she was in me, and how I'd ruined my mom's life. And my mom was so angry and depressed because of me and how selfish I was. And the visits were really fun. And she told me if my dad was still alive, how disappointed he'd be in me. And then she would tell me that she, too, was going to be dying soon. And that really scared me because, I mean, I didn't like her, but I didn't want her to die, and I didn't want my mom to have that kind of pain because I saw what it did when my dad died. And I found out later that she started telling my mom that she was dying when my mom was 9, and she had my mom when she was 18. So my grandma died from the age of 27 until 90 when she actually died. I believe it's the longest death on record. I'm not sure. So not a great relationship with my grandma. And so when my mom claimed bankruptcy and moved home to mother, I was like, cool. Cuckoo Town is all contained. Now I can live the way I want to live, which I'd been doing all along, which was just a train wreck. It was, you know, I looked like an adult on the outside, so you believed me when I made decisions, and people trusted me when I told them what I wanted and when I was telling them things, but I was completely incapable of doing anything. normal. And so life was difficult, but somehow I was able to continue drinking the way I was drinking. Another pattern that I set up early on is overlapping. And what I mean by that is, so you're in a relationship, and at the beginning you have those wonderful butterflies, and everything's just better, and every day is just the best day, and you know, all the problems you had yesterday just seem to have vanished, and you're just happy, happy, happy. And then, in a mature relationship, when those butterflies die down, a long-lasting love replaces those butterflies. But for me, I felt like if I wasn't feeling those butterflies anymore, it's because you're not doing what you used to do. And if you were doing those things, I'd still have those butterflies. And there's about 5,000 other things you're not doing. I'm going to list them for you. And then that wouldn't work out so well. And so then I would find somebody else who would give me the butterflies, and then I'd cheat on you, and then you'd dump me, and I'd go to the next person. Such a victim. Oh, poor me. I just want love. That's all this is about. So that overlapping was a pattern that I set up really early on. Again, thinking, I'm only hurting myself. You know, I'm such a victim, but I wasn't. And what happened was... I ended up having an affair with my married boss. Getting out of high school, I ended up getting this amazing job with a nonprofit in Pasadena, kind of high profile, and started having an affair with my boss who had four children, and he left his wife and his children for me, and it was a big scandal at work, and it was in the papers, and it was kind of a thing, and that was kind of the beginning of the end for me, because I had to leave that job, and I really loved that job, and I ended up finding another place to work, but he wasn't giving me the butterflies anymore, and I needed those. I needed your approval like I needed oxygen. I mean, it was that simple. It was my first higher power, your approval. And so what happened was, I was, again, very depressed, and I had another suicide attempt. I was living with a roommate who had a bottle of pain medication. She was out of town, so I took the bottle of pain medication. I drank a bottle of vodka, and then I realized that nobody was going to find me because my world had become really small by then, and I got scared, so I called the suicide hotline. And there was no answer, which is the story of my life. And so I called information. I found some other suicide prevention line. And I said, okay, this is what I took. This is what I drank. If I make myself sick, will I be okay? And they're like, no, you've got to call 911. I'm like, no, I don't want to. So I call 911. I'm like, okay, look, I'm speaking to you. I'm sitting up. I'm good. This is what I took. This is what I drank. If I make myself sick, will I be okay? They're like, no, we've got to send an ambulance. I'm like, oh, all right, well, we don't need the sirens and all of that. You know, I'll just be waiting. So the next thing I hear is, woo, woo, you know, and I'm running down the hallway of my apartment, and the paramedics come in, and they are totally hot. So, you know, I'm in that overlap period, so I'm like, how you doing? And they're like, we need to get you on the stretcher, ma'am. And I'm like, ooh. So they take me to the hospital, pump my stomach, and after you have your stomach pumped, you have the charcoal frown, you know, some work in the charcoal frown, and the doctor comes in and is supposed to put me on a 72-hour hold, but I talk him out of it because we're so good at that, you know, it's just, oh, whoopsie, just a mistake. And so they send me home, and I have this brilliant idea after I get a good night's sleep. I wake up and I realize that the paramedic station is just across the street, so I get all gussied up, gather my hair, look all cute, and I go over to say hello. And so I'm like, hi, remember me? I tried to kill myself last night. How's it going? And
I can't get up.
Yeah, let's get the paramedics here. I'm okay with that. Not anymore. So they were very kind to me and sent me away because they were used to dealing with crazy people. But the whole point of this story is I was so lonely, that kind of bone-chilling loneliness that I think only another alcoholic can identify with. So lonely, I hated myself so much that my only solution was to take my own life. And then in a moment, I'm kind of hot, maybe I'll get lucky. Like, what is that? How can that be happening at the same time? I don't understand. You know, one side of the coin is thinking you're the greatest, and the other side of the coin is thinking you're a piece of crap, and humility is found somewhere in between, and I think that's what we strive for as we go through, you know, the steps and the traditions. But anyway, so my roommate had a brother who had a little problem with crack cocaine, and his wife made such a big deal out of it and kicked him out, and he had no place to go. So she said, could he come stay with us? And I'm like, sure, why not? He was better. He hadn't been to a program or anything. It was just magic. He was just better. And so he came to live with us, and turned out he wasn't done with that crack pipe as it was. And I don't know about you, but it's really hard for me to be with somebody who has a different buzz. You know, like when I was a teenager and people would be getting stoned, passing around a joint, and they're laughing at stupid stuff. I'm like, you're so stupid. Give me some. Now I'm stupid, and it doesn't bother me. Or you go to a kegger party or something, and you see like three or four people go in the same bathroom stall, and you're like, oh, there they are. Okay, we're back on. You see about three or four people go into the stall together, and then they come out, and they're like, creepy. I remember my boyfriend going, babe, what? I didn't do anything. So, but then you get invited in, and then it's not so creepy. And so that's kind of what happened here. Danny was acting really weird, and I said, I want some, because there was just no way I could break up with him. There was no way I could. It was my only option. I had to join him. Seriously. That's where I was at. And so he said, no, you don't. I said, yeah, I do. And within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I lived. I got fired from my job, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20 at the time. And I had no place to go, and so I went to live with my best friend's parents, who live in La Crescenta, where I was born and raised. And my best friend Diana and I grew up together. We used to party together, but she grew out of it, moved to San Diego, was living a big life, going to school. Her family was a family that I would visit, and they would sit down to have dinner at the same time every night, and she and her brothers and sisters would talk about their day, and they'd talk about their dreams, and they would talk about their lives. And I mean, the way I ate was I ate SpaghettiOs and hamburgers and hot dogs on my lap in my room. I cooked whatever I could figure out how to cook. I didn't, like, I only saw that on TV. So sitting with Diana's family was a really big deal to me, and when I had no place to live, they took me in. And I was grateful for that. Now, I had not been a really great friend to Diana over the years. We'd been best friends since kindergarten, and she is the prettiest girl I know still. She's the sweetest girl. And for a period of time, she went and she was living with her dad and practicing a religion that you don't drink, smoke, have sex, whatever. I was doing all of those things. So when she came back, I kind of gave her a hard time about having not done any of those things. So in a very short period of time, she was up to speed. And I always felt bad about that, although I'm joking about it now. Over the years, you know, we partied, and she never really got into the hard stuff. She would drink, but when we started doing other stuff, she would just kind of hang out. But I remember one day we went to Reflections for brunch, which we thought we were, you know, kind of special doing that, you know, kind of a fancy lunch, the two of us going out, and they closed after brunch for dinner, but we stayed in there and just drank and drank and drank, and I think we got home that night like at 9 or 10 or whatever, and I remember just looking at her, and I just didn't like the look on her face, and I just clocked her, and I mean, but that's the type of stuff I did. I was not a good friend, and I really, had you talked to me when I was new, I would have told you what a stellar human being I was and how I was such a victim. And so anyway, but Diana had tried over the years to reach out to me and had basically just given up on me, except now that I had reached out for help. This was kind of her last effort at trying to help me. And so I lived with Don and Paula, her parents. Now, I knew drugs were a problem, so I was going to continue to drink, but then I thought, maybe that's a problem, and I tried to stay sober, and I'd been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with my friends who really needed it, because I'm a good friend, but I just never really thought it would work for me. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion, so I knew the God thing wasn't going to work, and sometimes I'd feel worse than you or better than you. I just knew it worked for all of you guys, but it's not going to work for me. And so I tried white-knuckling it, and I like to document things. So I'd keep track on my calendar, you know, like one day, cross it out, one day, cross it out. there's a lot of paperwork. And so what I decided was, if I was going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I poured my first guilt-free drink, and it was White Zin in the box. And the phone rang, and it was a guy who worked with Diana who'd been sober a while, and she'd been telling him about her loser friend, me. And he called and said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, my husband Vince and I are going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? And I did. And I get goosebumps every time I share that, because a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. And when I try to picture what God's grace is, I think of that moment. You know, that's kind of like the picture. And let me say this about Diana, too. So she got married about 6 months before I got sober. Oof, really rough. So she had gotten married when she was 18 and I was her maid of honor. I did the shower. I got the band. I mean, she may as well have married me. We were together the whole time. It was kind of our wedding. And so that didn't work out. So now she's getting married the second time. I'm not even allowed to see her before the wedding because I'm just such a mess, right? And so I go to the wedding. She gets married in a place called Fallbrook. Drive down there. We're all staying in a motel nearby. And I start getting my drink on, and by this time I know how I am. I know, and I can't control it. I don't know if I have one drink, if I'm going to be hammered, or I'll have 10 drinks and not feel it. I can't predict, but I'm going to drink. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I can't predict, but that doesn't stop me. So I'm getting hammered at her wedding, and then I'm looking at her, and she's in this beautiful tea-length white dress, and just, like I said, she's the prettiest girl I know. And I decide that because we've been friends since kindergarten and I'm her best friend, that the first dance should be with me. And and you really don't want to argue with me when I'm drinking. It's just not going to go your way. So it's just easier to just do it. And so the song I selected for our first dance was Joan Loke's Wild Thing. Working all week, 9 to 5 for my money. So... So there's Diana in her beautiful little tea-length dress, and I'm just bloated just from, because all I'm doing now is drinking. And there's pictures of me just grinding on her sweet little body and pictures, and it's just awful. And but I knew after that, like, there was something that just said, you must leave, you must leave. And I did, and went back to the motel, and there were a group of people there, and I kept going out to the jacuzzi, and I'd start drowning, and they'd put me back in the room, and then I'd come back out and drown, and, you know, back and forth, back and forth. I remember waking up, and there were several of us staying in one room, and there was, like, red stuff on all the walls when I woke up, and I was like, uh-oh. And then I looked, and there were pizza boxes. I'm like, oh, okay. And then I turned, and one of our friends that we grew up with had a piece of pizza hanging out of his butt singing Georgia. And Georgia! And I just... It was a very surreal time. But that was kind of what my life looked like at that time. So flash forward now, I go to this meeting with Pat and Vince, and I go to this meeting of the Pacific Group, which is more like what I'm seeing here tonight. The like lights are on in people's eyes. People are happy and sober at the same time, which I just couldn't even believe. How does that happen? And so I was intrigued, and Pat said that she'd be my sponsor until I found one. And started me on a really simple course of action, going to regular meetings on regular days and then getting commitments at those meetings. And she said she'd be my sponsor until I found one. And I had never had any structure in my life. As I mentioned, can you hand me my water? Thank you. So just having a little bit of structure in my life, I started feeling better right away. Like, I thought structure was the man trying to keep you down, people over 30 who don't understand freedom. And, you know, like, structure is for squares, you know. And so, but I had never had it, so I didn't know. So now, going to regular meetings on regular days, I get a little job to go to. And I start getting really happy. In fact, I was told by some of the old-timers in my group just how annoying I was. And but I was really, I just didn't know that there was hope for me. And I started feeling like there might be hope. And it seems like the more structure I had in my life, the more creative I was, the freer I felt. It was the polar opposite of what I thought it was. It's like the more structure I have, the more time seems to bend, the more I can do. And so I do want to say this about that. So, you know, I'm new, and people kept saying, oh, well, you're in that pink cloud. Wait till you hit year two. You know, and all these people who just could not stand the fact that I was happy. Let me just tell you, I was in my pink cloud for my first 6 years because I just did the stuff. When I'm doing the stuff, I can tap into that joy. It's when I stop doing the stuff, which in 6 years I'll get to that, but... So anyway, I was about 2 weeks sober, and a family friend came forward and told me all these secrets that my mom and grandma had kept from me. And I always knew that there was something weird about my mom and grandma, something between them. They seemed like they had to always be together, but they wounded each other, and they would punish each other with silent scorn. And I would be in the middle, and they'd say, you know your mother, you know your grandmother. I'd be like, ah. So there was always something between them I didn't understand. And they talked in a secret language, too, that was like a pig Latin, except it had Z's in it. Somebody said it's a carny language. I've heard somebody tell me this. It's got Z's in it, but it's like abadomba womba tuba goba tuba scuba, which is Fat Albert, but it's like that, but with Z's. So there were secrets between them. So I know I was not able to uncover any of these secrets. I fancy myself a bit of a detective, and I've been through all of their personal belongings over the year because I'm entitled to. And I never found anything. So the family friend came forward, told me all these secrets, and was like, I knew it! And so I wrote down everything that this friend told me. Because when you hurt me, I like to be super specific when I throw it in your face. So I had all of the things written down in detail. But instead of going to my mom, I went to my sponsor, which was different for me. And Pat said, it's so good you have that written down, because you're going to need that later. And I had no idea what she meant. She said, but for now, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. I was like, what? Now, let me just say this. By that time, I had made a decision that I was going to do everything that I was asked to do. And we kept talking about getting a first-year foundation. It's important to get that first-year foundation. That's what you're going to build the rest of your sobriety on. So I thought, I'm going to do everything I'm told for this first year. And then when it doesn't work, I can go back to my glamorous life. And luckily, I haven't had to do that. So when Pat said I had to be a good daughter and granddaughter, I have no idea what that means. So we came up with a formula, and that's that I'd call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit it off as often as I could. And if I were doing these things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter and granddaughter. This was not for them. This was so just maybe I could stay sober, because where they were concerned, I loved my mom and grandma. I felt fiercely loyal to them. I was always told it's just the three of us. You can't rely on anybody except us. It's just the three of us. And I resented them, and I was embarrassed of them, and I blamed them, and I felt guilty, and all of those feelings all at the same time. And I don't think I could have lived with that kind of angst. So I needed to get going on this living amends right away. And so I start sending the cards once a week, and I would get a card that already said something to write, love Georgia. And then eventually I picked up the pace, you know, because I get a bit grandiose, as I may have mentioned. And so I start writing these long letters about my adventures in sobriety, and then I start thinking about how they must be savoring each one of these cards, maybe saving them in a decorative box or maybe with a lovely bow, and maybe rereading them from time to time on a cold winter's night. Oh, remember this one? That Georgie. But that's not what was happening. I found out when I made my weekly call, so I'm making the weekly calls, which was really awkward, too, because I used to only call when I was in trouble, like, I have no money, I have no place to live, talk to you later, and then I wouldn't call for months. So every time the phone rang, they would be panicked. So they'd be like, we thought you were dead. No, just checking in, you know. So it took a while to kind of, for that to calm down. So I made my weekly call, and my mom said, well, we've been getting your cards, but Grandma's been having to wipe them out to reuse them, and we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. Anything to save a buck, you know what I mean? So, and I did. I wrote those cards in pencil, and I want to tell you why I did that. Because I now had a sponsor who told me I could bring all my problems to her and I'd never have to go through anything alone ever again. And I was starting to have an experience of a higher power as the result of going through the steps with a sponsor. And I was finding that I had more tools that I even knew existed. And it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility, and in this case it was me. So I wrote those damned cards in pencil. And for a little while, I wrote less to punish them, but they didn't notice. That's good, though. So writing the cards in pencil. And So my mom and grandma also believe that they should never have to call me. Real phone call went like this. Well, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call. And so, so I learned that on my birthday, I could do what I would normally do, which is pace by the phone, check my answering machine, Google it if you don't know what I'm talking about. You know, they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call. And then at the end of the day, say, I knew it. Or, new tool, call them on my birthday and say, today is my birthday. I just want to tell you I love you. Boom. Enjoy the rest of your day. I mean, these are crazy ideas that I'm learning. I mean, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was just not about drinking, but it was really about living, right? So... So I'm taking these actions. I'm going through the steps. I ended up changing sponsors twice my first year, three times my first year. I'm on my fourth sponsor. And let me say this about sponsorship, that I've never had a sponsor that's given me bad direction. I've always had just the people I needed in my life at just the right time. And today I know I'm with the right sponsor if I can answer it. Yes to two questions, and one is, do I want what they have, and the other is, do I trust their judgment? And if I can answer yes to those two questions, I know I'm with the right person. I don't need to debate their direction. I don't need to think, oh, have I outgrown them, is it time to change, or whatever. You know, I just know if I can answer yes to those two questions, that's where I am. But anyway, so I went through the steps. My big thing was I wanted to get through all the steps. My first year, boom, clean, hit that 1 year. And in our group, we have a watch when you turn one. So everybody gathers at a coffee shop, and they count down to midnight to your birthday. So it's 10, 9, 8. And so when they get to one, you know, they sing happy birthday, and may not translate here, but it is a really big deal. And I had maybe 200 people at my watch, and I knew, and as people are leaving, they stop at your table and shake your hand, and I knew everyone's name except for one. I thought, wow, how much my life had changed in just a year. And I'd kept the direction that I'd been given. Now, when I got sober, I thought, well, now I'm sober. I should go on a diet. I should get a good health plan. I should get a really good job. You know, I'm sober now. And, quit smoking. You know, I had all these plans of what I wanted to do now that I was sober to make up for all that lost time, and it's time for a relationship. But my sponsor had just come back to the get your first year foundation. All the time and energy you want to put into going into school, put that into getting your steps done. All the time and energy you want to put into a relationship, just put that into AA. Get a little job to go to in between meetings. Don't quit smoking. No major changes and no relationship. Which was just like, I couldn't understand. So, but I, like I said, I'm like, I'll do this, and then when it doesn't work, I can go back to my glamorous life. So now flash forward, I'm at my watch, I turned one, I stayed out of a relationship for that year, and about an hour and a half. I take things very literally, so at about 1:30 a.m., I consummated a relationship with my new fella. And then we were engaged 10 days later, and we got married 6 months later. And I was married to him my first 5 years of sobriety. And they were good years because we always put AA first. We always stayed really close to our sponsors. So when it didn't work out, surprise, we were both able to stay sober, and we're both still in the same home group. And, you know, when we did split up, though, I thought, you know, we were in the same home group. You know, maybe I could just go to some different meetings for a little while. You know, it's so painful. And I've always been taught that you walk through things with grace and dignity now, and that I was to show up at my regular meetings. I wasn't to change any of my meetings, but I wasn't to seek him out or to avoid him. But if I were to run into him, not to ask questions like, how you doing? Are you sleeping okay? Are you eating? Everything okay? So creepy. I was told instead, just statements if I ran into him, to say something like, it's good to see you. Have a great meeting. Just keep walking. And so that's what I did. And I ended up getting involved with someone else right away. There wasn't an overlap. But pretty much U-Haul. Hello. I just saw something flying around. Okay. No. Who said that? This could be very bad. All right. So, So I thought that this guy was going to be the guy. I'm super involved in AA. My life is just moving at a very high velocity. I'm working. I'm taking classes. I'm of maximum service. You know, 7 to midnight every day. Woo! 7 days a week. Go, 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 go. Action, action, action. And what happened for me is I had to have back surgery. I'd had minor back surgery early in sobriety, but I had to have a lumbar fusion, which if all went well, it was going to be a 6-month recovery time. And they were going through the front because it was better healing for your back muscles. But it was a longer recovery. And so I had that surgery, but I ended up being in the 1% where something goes wrong. And I ended up being bedridden for about 6 years. I was for about a year. I was 6 years sober at the time. And so I was slowly losing everything. I couldn't work anymore, so I lost that job. I couldn't drive, so I had to sell my car. I was having trouble paying bills. And then this guy that I thought was going to be the guy ended up dumping me. He said that he would consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well. And I remember calling my sponsor, because I would call her with each installation of my pain, like, this happened and that happened and this. So now I call her. And at the time, she was learning to play guitar, so I would hear her plucking away in the background from time to time. So I'm like, and now I got dumped. And she said, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression and sang my blues, and it made me laugh. And I'm so grateful for laughter, you know. I'm grateful that I have a sponsor who finds so much humor in my most difficult times. That's actually helped me quite a bit. I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, and it's a disease of your sympathetic nervous system. And your sympathetic nervous system is your fight and flight responses. And so what it does, this disease sends a pain message where there is an injury. So it's a misfiring of your nerves that affects your bones, your nerves, your blood vessels. I mean, it's pretty serious. And in the olden days, they would just amputate the affected limb, or you could end up paralyzed. And so the doctor that I was seeing had a patient before me that he was unable to diagnose for about a year. He finally diagnosed him. So when I came in, they thought it was a blood clot, tested me. It wasn't that. He knew exactly what it was and sent me to this doctor who was a specialist and was kind of doing this stuff out of the box. He was trying all these new treatments. And so I was going to the hospital 3 times a week. And I'd go Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and they do cervical and lumbar punctures, you know, big needles in my neck and back, and nerve blocks and epidural blocks. And the way it showed up was in my left leg. And so they would fill my left leg with this IV fluid for like 40 minutes. And I mean, it was a difficult time. And it was my AA group that took care of me. My mom and grandma weren't able to be there for me for whatever reason. They both had vehicles and what have you. But it was my AA group. You know, I look back at the difficult times I've been through, and I think, you know, I think I'm not alone here. We think that certain people should be there or, you know, whatever. But what I've come to find out is that just the people I needed have always been there. You know, if I look back at my life from here, I see how beautifully orchestrated it's been up until this moment. But even now, I'm like, but this time it's not going to work out. Mm-mm. But that's one thing that comes with having a little bit of time and experience is when I was new, I had to believe you. I had to believe your experience. But now I have the experience that tells me that everything's been beautifully orchestrated to this point, so I have to believe in this moment it is too. Going to the hospital, you know, doing all this stuff. People are taking me to AA meetings. I'm putting a beach chair in the back of the room, and I'm laying down during my Saturday night meeting, my Wednesday night meeting, and then the other nights people are bringing me food, and I have to have babysitters every night, and I have people babysitting me that honestly I wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with. I'm like, ooh, no, not her. But I started to get to know people at this whole different level. I had to learn to work a whole new program, you know, because my program had been based on action, 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 and now, you know, the brakes were on, and it was like, whoosh. And so I had to learn a whole new way to operate. And I had found all that love that I'd been wanting so much my whole life, that the only way that that emptiness gets filled is by giving. It's by being of service. It's when I'm lonely, I have to pick up the phone. It's the actions that I take that fill that emptiness. Getting is good. Getting feels good. But it's never filled that emptiness. So now I'm in a place where I can't be of service, but I learned that allowing people to help me was a way that I could be of service. And so I'm dealing with, thank you, I'm dealing with having just been dumped, and there's a guy in the group named Mike Finch, and he had been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. He was 34 years old, and he was dying of ALS or living with ALS. And his wife had also left him when he was sick. And I had watched him go from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down. But the thing that never changed about him was his love of Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to say there's no cure for ALS except for AA. And he sponsored all these guys, and he would bring them in his handicapped van from Las Vegas to the Wednesday night Pacific group meeting, and then he ended up moving to San Diego. Come up every Wednesday, and he was so joyful, and that was such an attraction for me. And, you know, I can pray for a character defect to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. Like with my mom and grandma, I had the sense of entitlement, and the solution was love and tolerance, and so, or the action. And so now, you know, I'm full of uselessness and self-pity, and then enrolls Mike, and so we became friends, and then we became more than friends, and I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. And my dad had stomach cancer, and so when he was dying, they ran out of surgeries to do, and they did this guinea pig operation where they left an open hole in his stomach. And so when he was at home, he'd be in a reclining chair, tipped back, but if he moved, stuff would come out, it would burn his skin, and my mom used to have to put tubes and put medicine in it. It was really gory. And I was, you know, I was 6 years old. I was daddy's little girl. I didn't even know who my mom was until after my dad died. I was like, I was locked on my dad. I loved my dad. And so one day I asked my mom if I could help. And so I was holding on to one of these tubes, but then I got really scared and I let go and it sprayed everywhere. And it was one of those memories. I'd be walking like just down the street and it would pop into my head, you know, and there's nothing I could do to stop it. And so flash forward, I'm with Mike, he's getting sicker, and now he has to have a feeding tube. And he says, I want Georgia to feed me. And I'm like, no. I'm like, ha, 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 you know, like total horror movie. No. I said, you have to tell me that if it sprays everywhere, that would be okay. And he said, no, that would be really bad. And so I told him what had happened with my dad, and he said, well, let's just try. And so I did, and I was able to walk through that. And I didn't think Alcoholics Anonymous would give me a solution for that, you know. There's so many things that have been healed through this program that I just never imagined. And so, of course, I became the number one feeder and medicine giver. I'm like, no, I've got this. And so I was able to walk through that. And falling in love with Mike, I found something redeemable in me. Because I'd always measured love in what I was getting. Like, if you asked me if I had love in my life, I would tell you who loved me versus how I love, because that's what really fills me up. And so this was really an important lesson in that, and falling in love with him, something changed in me. And I wouldn't have chosen to love somebody that I knew was going to die, but we never know how much time we have. And I think, not just as an alcoholic, but as a human being, I'm such a coward when it comes to my emotions, you know. But AA has given me this beautiful net, you know, with sponsorship and God and the steps and everything that we have here, this beautiful net that I've been able to risk big things, risk breaking my heart, risk doing things that I'm scared to do but I've dreamed of doing, you know, because it doesn't break me anymore. It's not going to break me, you know, because I've got that net. And so those days with Mike were magnificent, and they were horrible, and they were scary, and they were gory, and they were sad, and they were beautiful, and I got to feel all of it. I got to feel all of those emotions. You know, I've run my whole life from feeling things, and now I don't want to miss any more moments. I don't want to miss any more moments. I've missed so many. And so it was a wonderful time. I used to call him, this is so tacky, but I used to call him the Make-A-Wish Boy, which, you know, he had a really good sense of humor, so it was okay with him. But you know, when you know you're dying, you live a different way. And so he lived with great joy, and I became close with all of the people who were helping to take care of him. And my health, I still have chronic pain today, and I was still going through treatment back then, and I wasn't sure if I would ever be able to work again or even really walk again. And but because I had had that aggressive treatment, I was doing a lot better. And today I still have chronic pain, and I'm just going to say this about chronic pain, which is we're not supposed to say our case is different. But if you have chronic pain, your case is different, but maybe not the way you're hoping I'm going to say, which is for me, it means I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. And today I treat my pain with Pilates and AA. And if you have any suggestions, No. I don't need any, but thank you. But if you do suffer from chronic pain, I feel for you. But anyway, so I was still with Mike at that time, and he was getting sicker, and he went into hospice, and I was able to be there when he died, which it doesn't always happen that way, but I feel like that was a blessing. And he was surrounded by love in AA, and it was all of us in AA who took care of him until the end. And about a month before Mike died, my grandma had passed away. Now, by the time my grandma died, she'd become a nice grandma. I don't know when that happened, but it was like I wanted people to see the new me and to believe that I was the new me. And one day my grandma changed, and she started sending me cards and telling me that she loved me. Well, the cards were my notes erased. But, it's something. But she would start telling me, grandma loves you, and I'm so proud of you. And I don't know when that changed, but I think just as our disease ripples out into the lives of the people we love, so does our recovery. And I slipped a card through in pen at some point, probably maybe 3 years into this thing. And I called my mom, and she said, "Well, we got your card. It was in pen." And I said, "Oh, dear." And I wasn't feeling that spiritual that day, so I quickly got off the phone. I'm like, "Oh, look at the time. I've got to run." And I called Marilyn, who's now been my sponsor for the last 23 years. And I said, "That's it. I write. I call. I visit. I'm done." And Marilyn said, "I think you've made a wonderful amends to your mother and grandmother, and you don't owe them anything else." And I went, "Yes." And she said, "However, I think it would be a wonderful spiritual exercise if you continue to do so." And so I did. And that's kind of how she gives me direction. I'll say, "So, Marilyn, I'm looking at option A or option B." And she'll say, "Well, you could do option A, or you could fight for the good. It's up to you." Really? So this lesson that I learned with my mom and grandma was that I am only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on your side of the street, none of my business. In fact, the dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. The only power I have any access to is over here. It's not over there. Now I have fiddled about over on your side of the street. And I probably will again. But I know the power isn't there. But sometimes I forget. But it was such an important lesson just to learn that I am only responsible for my side of the street. So when my grandma died, I had a good relationship with her. And then I started writing the cards in pen again. Let me just say that. But I was able to be there for my mom. And walk through that with her. And I wasn't able to be there when my dad died, and she grieved so horribly over that. And so I was able to be a positive influence in her life. And so I had moved. Mike passed away, and I moved back to Los Angeles, and my mom asked to see me. So I drove up to where she was living, and she said that there were some things she wanted to tell me, but she was waiting until my grandma was gone, because she was very loyal to my grandma. And she told me all those secrets I'd written in that book when I was 2 weeks sober that I had not found necessary to throw in her face all those years. I'm so grateful, too. So she sat down and told me basically her life story over a two-day period. And she told me that when my grandma was 8, she was sent to live with another family because my grandma's family couldn't take care of her and her sister. And so my grandma went to live with another family where she was kind of the house girl. She cooked and cleaned, and she was physically and sexually abused in that house and never went to another day of school. And the way she got out of that, she got pregnant with my mom at 18 and married a man she didn't love. And by the time my mom was born, she had already divorced that man. And so then she started the same thing with my mom, sending her to live with other families, same thing happening to my mom, leaving her at boarding schools. My mom was raised Catholic, and she'd go to these Catholic boarding schools. Well, she was raised Catholic by the boarding schools, not by my grandma. And I think my grandma just, it was a place to take my mom, but she'd forget her for summers. And So finally, my mom went to live with her dad and her stepmom, but my grandma would come to visit, and she'd be in these fancy cars and have furs and, you know, shiny objects, jewelry, fancy jewelry, and just looked like her life was really exciting. And so when given the choice, you go with your mom today, and you never see your dad again. She had to make a choice, and so she decided to go with my grandma. My grandma, it turned out, although she said that she would go off to Mojave to be a nurse, I guess she was in kind of a way. She had turned to racketeering and prostitution, and she was a madam at one of those places in Mojave, and she turned my mom out to work the same business when my mom was 15, and so my mom never went to another day of school, and was physically and sexually abused by the people coming in and out of the house, and my mom was pregnant at 15 and pregnant at 16 and put both of those children up for adoption. And while she was pregnant with those children, my grandma had thought that my mom had seduced her boyfriend or whatever. I don't think that's what happened. So she would kick my mom out when she was pregnant, and while she was pregnant, she lived on the streets of Hollywood and slept in doorways, and you know, if anybody would help her, give her food or give her a place to sleep until she would have the child, put it up for adoption. And so after those two pregnancies, she went another route with the future pregnancies. But sitting here with my mom and listening to her tell me her story, I couldn't believe that that was my mom. I couldn't believe the life that she had had. And so the secrets that I had found out were not even close to that. The family friend had told me that my mom and dad were not really married, that they had lied to me about that, that my dad was an alcoholic and a womanizer, and that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me. And some of those things were true, sort of. So my mom was my dad's mistress, and when he died, his survivor benefit went to his wife and to me because I was his child. So she didn't get anything. He had had an affair with a neighbor and had a child that the neighbors were raising as their own, so it turns out I have quite a few siblings out there, although I was raised an only child. But so the secrets that I had found out were very minor compared to what my mom had told me. And I was so grateful as she's telling me this horrific story, which I've never heard a worse story inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've told you kind of in a general way, but it's the worst story I've heard. I was so grateful that I've been given that direction to treat my mom and grandma with respect and love, even though I didn't feel it. And it's in taking the actions that the feelings follow. So as I was taking these loving actions toward my mom and grandma, I was feeling the love as I'm doing it. Regardless of how they receive it, I was experiencing the love. And the more I did nice things for them, the more I loved them. And I'm so grateful that I've been given that and taken that direction rather than follow the well-meaning suggestions of therapists, who, of course, I lied to, and friends who would say, you know, talk about setting boundaries and confronting and all of these kind of aggressive stances, when in Alcoholics Anonymous we're taught about love and tolerance. And I thought that I spent my whole life being angry with my mom for not giving me what I thought I needed, which was love and direction and these things that she did not possess. I thought she possessed them and found me unworthy of having them, like she withheld them from me. But they were things she never possessed. So it was insane that I was mad at her for not giving me something she never had, and what freedom there was in that. And I had learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and to my girlfriends, and so I got to get to love Betty, and I used to call her Boop, and she was so funny and so beautiful and so smart and so broken, and the way that her brokenness showed was in hoarding. She turned into a hoarder, like the kind you see on TV, scary hoarder. And so there was one point where I was going to report her to somebody, I don't know who. I'm like, I'm going to report her. And Marilyn suggested that I just be a good daughter, and that she has her own higher power and I'm not it, and that I can offer to help, but outside of that, you know, let her live her life. And that's what I did, and I got to love my mom exactly where she was. And when I would go for the visits to see her, I couldn't stay with her because there wasn't room in her house. It was very strange. But But what I did is instead of looking at the trips to see her as vacation for me, I started looking at them as opportunities to make this living amends, as service. And the more I thought of how I could make her happy, the better the trips would be. I'd pack my car with CDs of music she liked. We'd go thrift shopping and all these crazy things to fill her house with more stuff. But we ended up having this really sweet relationship, and I'm so grateful that I followed the direction in Alcoholics Anonymous to do that, because I would have missed it all. And several years later, she was diagnosed with cancer. She had lung cancer, and she actually had a 5-way bypass, and when she was having that surgery, they found the cancer, and she was treated and lived about a year and a half after that, but then it came back, and it was in her bones, and it went to her brain. And so I was able to spend the last few months of her life with her. And I was able to use some of the stuff that I learned while taking care of Mike in taking care of her. She didn't have anybody else in her life. It was just me. Like I said, she didn't really have any other friends. She never dated again. And when we talk about that place of regret, I still have some where she is concerned. She wanted to die in her home, and I couldn't do it alone, and I ended up putting her somewhere. And but because I was taking care of her by myself, I gave her the best I had, but I didn't give her the best that was available. I could have tapped into Alcoholics Anonymous in the town where she lived. I could have asked for more help, and I didn't. And so that's kind of a regret that I'm hoping I'm going to use to either maybe help somebody here tonight, or maybe something, you know, the next time I'm in a situation like that, I would do things differently. So I went to spend the last few months of her life with her, and we were going to the hospital for yet another treatment. She's like 75 years old. I don't even know why we're going for another test, and the x-ray technician comes out. And my mom is so sick, and she just looks at him, and she says, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" She was so funny. And I just laughed and laughed and laughed. And I was given that gift as a result of, you know, following some direction here. And when my mom died, I was just sure that I would too, because I adored her. And I had a great deal of support in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, my life today is really good. I still struggle with some of the things I mentioned today. You know, the struggle isn't over. It's the power that I give it today, I think, that's different. I still have, you know, really funky thoughts. I wake up and I'm like, woo, where'd that come from? But now what I do, part of my third step practice, is when I'm asked to do something, if my calendar's open, I say yes. So what that looks like is my calendar's usually packed. So I kind of set aside those thoughts and start on my day of what's coming up next. And next to getting sober, the best thing that's happened to me is the job I have today working at the Midnight Mission. And I get to take the love and the hope I get in these rooms and outside spaces to Skid Row every day. And you know, music has always been a really important part of my life. It was my my first real friend when I was a kid. It was, you know, I heard music and the lyrics said how I felt, and it somehow soothed me, and it got into places in me that nothing else could. And so I always found singing really cathartic, but not so much for my audiences, as it turns out. Now, I've taken lessons. I've done a bunch of AA shows, you know, because they're for fun and for free, and you get what you pay for. But there was a point in time that I was so heartbroken by this, because people say, well, what's your passion? What's your desire? I found myself with double-digit sobriety in a horrible funk, and I didn't know if I wanted to be a grocery checker or a brain surgeon. I had no passion for anything except for this. And I thought, how cruel is it that God would give me this passion and desire and then have me suck at it? You know, that just seems like a cruel twist of fate. But flash forward, I get the job at the Midnight Mission. And so I started a music program there in 2010 where I bring musicians to play for our homeless guests, people who don't have access to music, and bring music to them. Because it's been such a huge part of my life, and it's been such a healing thing for me. And so in this whole thing, what I learned was that maybe God gives us those passions and desires not for us to shine, but for it to shine through us. So I follow those things. When I have a passion or desire for something, I don't know why I'm doing what I'm doing, but I know if I have it there, God's put it there. So I need to follow it, whatever that is. And my relationships are different today. I was always looking for somebody to complete me. It's such a romantic notion. You complete me. Ah, but what that means is without you, I'm incomplete. Now you're responsible for my happiness, and you're not going to be able to make me happy, and I'm going to have to overlap you. And so, so as the result of that horrible time with double-digit sobriety when I found myself suicidal again, I went through the steps again, beefed up my program, and finally became complete, you know, through the program, complete. I'm not looking for somebody to complete me. The people in my life enhance my life today. And I'll just share this. I've got a couple minutes. So so I got married and divorced again in sobriety, and went through this time that I just discussed, and finally was happy again. I was single. I was happy. I wasn't looking for anything, and I ended up falling in love. And it was different because this time I was looking for what I could bring to the relationship, and I'd never been happier. And we were together a long time. Well, long for me. We were together several years before we moved in together, before we got engaged, you know, no U-Haul on the second date. And knew all of his friends, knew his family. We did everything together, and I trusted him, and he, I gave him full access to my heart and soul, and which is the way I would do it anyway, even now. But what happened was I found out my gut wouldn't shut up. I kept feeling like something was wrong, and my sponsor said, you know, I think you're trying to sabotage the best thing that ever happened to you. I had no proof, no nothing, but one night I couldn't stand it anymore, and I checked his phone, and I found out that he'd been lying to me since day one. And there were several other people. I lost count at several dozen, and it had been going on the whole time, and everything that I thought we had was a lie, and he'd been lying to me the whole time, and he was really good at it. And the thing was, is that I got, because of our program, that it wasn't about me, it wasn't personal. And in fact, when I first found out in that shock bubble, and Sandy Beach talks about that, like you have that moment of shock when you first find something out, the first thing I said to him was, I cannot imagine how lonely this has been for you. And I'm so proud of that. After that, there was a little head spinning and maybe some brain bombing. But in that shock bubble, there was some real good stuff. But everything I do every day is based on the idea that people can change. I work at the Midnight Mission. I see it all the time. And Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I needed to bring that home. And so, and that was hard. And it was hard to keep remembering it wasn't about me. But nobody in his life knew. It was a secret he kept from everyone in his life. It was a whole secret life. And I stayed as long as I could. But the thing about doing that is that I left with no regrets. I do not have a regret. I can't carry the weight of regrets anymore. And so I did everything I could to stay. It didn't work out. And here's the good news, is that it didn't break me. I was brokenhearted, appropriately so. I had an appropriate emotion to what happened. But it didn't break me. Just like I said, there's this beautiful net in Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to take these big risks, to love in ways that I'm scared to, and to dream big, you know. And it's all a result of this wonderful program. And thank you for listening. All right.